Welcome back, everyone, to our 21st episode of But Why Though, a philosophy-themed comedy podcast with comedian Josh Carter
and philosopher Nancy Lopez.
And today we actually wanted to do something different. We wanted to give a few shout outs to all of our listeners popping up. We see you, we do acknowledge you, and we do appreciate you.
Yeah, thanks so much. I didn't even know that we were international. Yeah, we have loyal listeners. Should we just do some shout outs from some random small towns to make people feel special or what?
Yeah. Where are these people at?
Here, let's do some loyal ones first. And okay. And I'll tell you what, you leave comments on our statuses and stuff and go on our Instagram, we'll give you a shout out too, or if you want to just keep listening to us. We'll try to get through and give some, we can't give everyone a shout out, obviously, but, you know, I'm going on and on. Here, shout out. We got people in France listening to us. This person's been listening to us from the very beginning from, I don't even know how to pronounce this, Cliché L'Ide France. Thank you. Thank you for listening for like basically since we were first doing this during the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah, right, loyal listener. We appreciate you.
We got someone from Hamtramck, Michigan listening. Thank you for listening to us. We love you, Hamtramck. I'm a big fan of Hamtramck, Michigan. There's really good Polish food there. I've been there actually. Okay. I've done comedy there. We have someone on our last episode from Moscow, oh snap, all sorts of places. North Glen, Colorado, what's up? Canton, Michigan, what's up? We had someone from Africa, somewhere.
San Jose, San Francisco.
Yeah, those are our big ones. What's up, San Jose, Bay Area? Who's listening from Austin? We had a bunch of people from Austin on the last episode. Okay, we're getting or it's too long. Okay, let's right. Talk about today's episode
so,
now.
So who
we just wanted to show y'all some love. That's all. Okay, so today's episode.
Who do we have, Josh?
We got Anna Gottlieb, who is a very accomplished philosophy professor at Brooklyn College. She has her doctorate degree and a law degree. She's written two books that you could get on Amazon. Check them out. One is called The Moral Psychology of Sadness, and the other one's called The Moral Psychology of Regret. You should definitely check those out. We also have Los Angeles-based comedian Danny LaBelle, an old friend of mine. I used to watch all his comical radio, even before I did comedy, when I was like in college at Texas A&M. I'd watch it. I got into comedy. Ended up meeting him randomly. We actually at the one and only show I've ever had at the Comedy Cellar. He was there. We met, and the rest is history. We became friends. He has a bunch of great things he's been on. He's had a TED Talk that he's given. He's like toured all over. He's been on WTF with Mark Maron. He's been on the Howard Stern wrap-up show. He's been on Dr. Drew's podcast. He's been on Risk. He's been on the Artie Lang show. He's all over the place. He also even has like a philosophy podcast. I didn't even realize that anyone else did a philosophy podcast in the comedy world. But yeah, check it out. It's called The Modern Day Philosophers. And apparently it's pretty sweet. But anyway, we had a really great episode today. It was a total clash of personalities. This is what I love. I love like the melding of the minds, bringing everyone together and hearing everyone's opinion and hearing how they react to other people's opinion. I think that really is a great way to tell who knows what they're talking about. Anyway, strap in your seatbelts. This is the But Why Though podcast.
So today we're going to be talking about the death penalty, and I'll just give you guys some brief history. The death penalty was first established back in the 18th century BC, so it's been around for a long time, and ever since then there's been a lot of cases of it trying to be taken away at a certain extent, but then it comes back in some ways as well. So in the United States, for example, in June 1972, in Furman versus Georgia, the Supreme Court effectively voids 40 death penalty statutes and suspends the death penalty. But so they suspended it in 1972, but 4 years later, in 1976, Gregg versus Georgia, guided discretion statutes approved, death penalty reinstated. So the US is one of the last developed countries in the West who still have it. And in some states, even hanging is still something that is legal, which I thought was pretty crazy.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Just Oregon, although Oregon is a moratorium on its death penalty right now. So I'm not sure you could get hanged in Oregon right now.
Yeah. Okay.
I think you could get mushrooms there, though.
You could get everything. Yeah. Actually, small substances of any drug.
You could do those suicide machines.
I mean, small amounts. What?
They have those suicide machines in Oregon, right? Where you could get in and, like, they'll play your favorite song and just lightly gas you to death.
It's they have a Death with Dignity Act. I'm not sure it's a suicide machine.
No, but there's, like, they've released, like, this technology that's, like, the most expensive way to commit suicide. And it's, like, a luxury machine that, like, does it very subtly and to your favorite TV show or song. I read about
What would you watch?
I don't know. Probably some sci-fi.
Sci-fi? You drift into the unknown?
Galaxy. I'm going into space right now.
So it'd be like little Star Wars or something?
Yeah, maybe something like that.
I want something relaxing, like the ocean or something.
So maybe it could be argued that Oregon brought back the death penalty in the form of overdosing from drugs.
Well, you could always overdose from drugs in Oregon.
Well, anyone, you can overdose from drugs anywhere because you're usually doing drugs illegally that you're overdosing on.
Yeah. Yeah, but Oregon has always been pretty loosey-goosey with it. Yeah. Now it's just official. Now you can have small amounts of pretty much any drug legally.
Like even heroin and stuff?
I don't know about heroin, but there's a lot of them on the list. And D.C., I think, just made mushrooms legal.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
New York State still can't get behind marijuana. So
we're going to steal all the tourism from Amsterdam.
Yeah, right.
We need it after Corona. We're going to have all drugs legal.
So are we just going to talk about drugs? We can talk about drugs, whatever.
Oh, no, okay. Well, we'll continue on. Let's continue on with this.
I'll mention the first philosopher I wanted to bring up. So philosopher Stephen Nathanson, in his work, An Eye for an Eye, discusses how it is actually difficult to know how much punishment someone deserves. If we take an eye for an eye, quote unquote, then an equal retribution would be a punishment equal to the crime committed. But this would then lead to morally unacceptable punishments. For example, then we would have to rape rapists. We wouldn't know how to treat drug dealers or prostitutes also. What I wanted to ask is, are we doing this today? Are we punishing people for the amount they deserve? Is the death penalty too harsh, or does it serve justice?
We technically do rape rapists, though. They all, like, rapists in jail all get raped, don't they?
Yeah.
Well,
you know, Alexander has a great joke about that, where he says if he ever went to jail, if someone tried to rape him, he'd immediately rape back. So you got the reputation that this guy rapes back. You got to watch out. He tells it better, obviously.
I'm not sure if I have anything to add to that except, who's the we here? Yeah, I mean, like, I found the question of, like, do people deserve something to be a very hard one? Like, what do we all deserve? How do you know that somebody deserves something and then somebody else doesn't? Especially when it comes to punishment.
Shouldn't a punishment, isn't the point of a punishment rehabilitation? So it's not.
That's only on one theory, right? Other people might think the point of punishment is retribution or deterrence.
Well, retribution, to have someone die quick, I don't think that would be retribution, especially if we're putting all this money into trying to humanely kill people by giving them the lethal injection, which is
not very humane, by the way. We're failing.
Yeah, but we're putting in so much money when we could. I feel like it'd be just way cheaper just to let them walk off the roof or something.
basically.
I feel like that's way quicker than death too, and it you don't waste taxpayers' dollars.
You know, that's what pirates used to do, right? Pirates used to make people walk the plank. Is that what we should be doing?
The good thing about walking the plank is that
if we did do it, why do we put so much money into doing all these weird, crazy type things like
leaping? What do you think?
I guess it's a business.
Why? So are you asking why are we spending so much money on the death penalty, or why what? You know, why are we?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we should have it. And then the fact that it's so expensive to maintain is also like another reason why you shouldn't have it. So what's the reason for it?
Should we have it? So let me ask you, if it was free, should we do it? If it costs us nothing?
I mean, I wouldn't be, if it was completely free, I would still want it to be super rare and only for certain cases. There are too many, I don't think anyone innocent should ever have a chance of getting it. You know, it has to be like, somebody who's like an evil villain or something, like some like real life version of Dr. Evil or something like that.
Like Jeffrey Dahmer?
I don't think it needs to be criminals like Jeffrey Dahmer don't need to be put to death. Like the types of people who do are the types who will incite like crazy like changes in like violent changes in society. Like people like,
well, you know what Jeffrey Dahmer did, right?
Well, Jeffrey Dahmer is like just a mass murderer. You could throw him in jail for life. You don't have to kill him.
He's a cannibal.
I understand that. He's just crazy. He's a mentally ill person.
Okay. So you know,
not like somebody who's like a threat to be alive to society, though. You could just lock him up and he won't.
Mm-hmm. Well, couldn't we do that with anybody? Just lock them up instead of killing him?
Well, if it's someone who's super smart and who has followers who could break them out, then maybe you should kill them.
I don't know.
If it's a modern day version of Hitler, and somehow he was like under U.S. custody and we had him in jail and he had a bunch of people who wanted to break him out, then maybe I think someone like that, like the death penalty, that's the only person I would say like the death penalty could be used for.
So Hitler.
People are obsessed with Hitler. You ever notice how people just, you know, they can't, there's no other references anymore for evil. There've been so many bad guys in history, but people love to hate Hitler. I mean, well, not that I like Hitler. I mean, I've certainly got...
He's kind of hateable.
Of course he's hateable. But I mean, it's almost... I guess I feel like it's... I want more variety.
Oh, you want more people to hate?
More conversational variety. Like throw in Genghis Khan or something, or...
Mussolini.
Stalin was pretty bad, right?
Stalin was very bad.
Yeah, Mussolini. I mean, but everybody loves... Wow. I mean... Well, they go right to Hitler. It's like when I was an intern at the Colbert Report, and they wanted a prop for the props department. I used to have to go to this warehouse of props up in Harlem and find a prop for the thing. And they'd always want the thing that easily sells the idea the most. So if it's like a fruit, you know, generally they'd be like, go find like the most basic, like a red apple, whatever. The Occam's razor type of thing, just cut right to the thing. And I guess that's why everybody goes right for Hitler, but there must be more variety of bad guys. I mean, that more appropriately fit certain things.
Well, when I say Hitler, what I really should say is the type of person I think should get the death penalty is someone who like is someone who has like a lot of power and who could like overpower and like who is a threat to overpower like the current government.
You know, you mentioned Hitler. I invoke Godwin's law. You know what Godwin's law is?
Yeah, I know.
I don't.
Tell him.
That whoever mentions Hitler first in an argument loses.
Really? I mean,
the longer an online conversation goes on, the higher the chances that Hitler will be mentioned by somebody.
Really?
And it didn't even take us that long.
I'm not arguing. I was just trying to illustrate like the few people who I would be okay with getting a free death sentence.
So you're saying that if someone is a threat to the government, if they've committed a bunch of
murders,
genocide, then they should get the death penalty.
If they can't be rehabilitated, if you're afraid of them, if you're afraid that they could get out somehow illegally and like kill more people in any way, or like
change. What about Charles Manson? He's been there
Like Charles Manson would be a better candidate to me than Jeffrey Dahmer.
Because he has followers?
Yeah, because he has a following of people.
But notice that nobody ever broke him out.
You know what it is also? Hitler had a book. A lot of these guys never wrote a book. I think that's part of it. Did anybody read Mein Kampf?
No.
I got halfway through it. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't funny. It was a little dry.
It was meant as a comedy bit, but
actually, I'll tell you a funny anecdote about when I didn't technically read it. I was listening to the audiobook of Mein Kampf, which is even weirder.
Hold up, there's an audio version of Mein Kampf.
Who do they have? Who's the reader?
Who the fuck? I'm sorry. Who the hell reads it? Who is reciting this shit?
Look it up for you. It's not Hitler, you know.
No,
of course.
I'm just wondering who they.
It was. I'd wonder. Like he'd have to take English classes. Knew it like in different languages.
Mein Kampf, by Adolf Hitler, read by Michael Ford. So
don't know who
there
that
you
is.
Go. So I'm driving around, and I've got it playing on the Bluetooth of my stereo, and I'm listening to Mein Kampf because, you know, I've heard about it my whole life, and I'm the grandson of a Holocaust survivor, and I thought, you know, I'd kind of like to hear what he says, you know? Know your enemy, right? So personally, it's fairly – I'm going to play you a little bit of the – just so you can hear what the guy sounds like.
Seriously, do I have to share audio with Hitler?
Yeah, why not?
Let's move on, because it's like on Zoom.
That the whole thing was carried on seemed to me unworthy of its great model.
That doesn't sound like Hitler, right?
Yeah, we have a British guy. Like,
what?
It's weird. Yeah, it is. It is kind of funny that it's like a British guy reading it.
Right. It should have been like the problem with the diet, somebody like that, right?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I'm driving around and I go to my office Christmas party and it's at this little restaurant in Malibu where they had a valet Parker. And I forget the fact that I'm listening to Mein Kampf on the car stereo. And I give him the keys. And he gets in the car, and it says on my display, I don't know if we lost Anna. Did we lose her?
No, I'm here.
Okay. It says on the display screen,
you're cutting out, so.
Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. And it's like, you know, the guy like gets in the car and to drive it, and it's like, and I realized the problem with the Jew was, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, like, I got to get away from, like, who does he must be like, who the hell's car is this? Like, you know, I...
That reminds me of a story. I have the opposite thing happen to me. I was like listening to the Bible just for reference, just because I want to like know it back and forward, like because I feel like it would help me in a lot of different areas and stuff. So I'm just like listening to the Old Testament, like from back to forward. And I was like a real estate agent at the time, and I was like taking people around. And when I started my car, like Bible scriptures just started coming on. And then I like quickly like turned it down, and then my clients were like, "Oh, was that scripture?" And they like would not stop giving me business. Then it completely helped me because they were like Christian dudes, I guess, and they never saw a real like, and they like completely trusted me with everything.
That's great.
I don't know, like I don't know what's wrong with you people, but like I listen to Radiohead when I'm driving. I don't understand like why.
Anna, mix it up a little.
I try to mix it up and listen to books sometimes to try to educate myself. But
yeah,
like,
I read books all the time. When I'm driving, I'm like, I'm away. I need some music.
I hear you.
Yeah. Music is nice.
Music is definitely better. It's easier on the ears, but like I feel like I'm being productive if I have a long drive and I have like an audio book that I could finish.
Wait a minute. Josh, come on, man. You're telling me you're going to sit here on this podcast and honestly say that music is easier on the ears than Mein Kampf?
Oh,
all right, let's move
all
on.
Right,
let's
I'll move on to our next philosopher. The philosopher Van Den Haag discusses how there is no proof to show that the death penalty deters crime, but there is also no proof to show that it doesn't. He believes that regardless if it does, we should still have it since it is the only fitting retribution for murder. He believes that just because it is being applied unjustly, it doesn't mean we should take it away. He states that if we are killing, so if like people, as we have seen throughout history, the death penalty has targeted Black people and Latinos mainly. And he says, well, if this is happening, if injustice is happening, then if we're killing more Black people than white people, then you don't stop killing people, you just start killing more white people. And I remember we talked about this in class and I thought it was pretty crazy. I was like, what? So I wanted to ask you guys, what do you think? Does the death penalty deter crime? Is this the only form of retribution for murder? And if it is causing injustice, is this the way to fix it?
I think that no matter what, there's always going to be people who get like judged by their cover and like either judge more harshly or less harshly.
Yeah.
So for that reason alone, that's why I'm against the death penalty. So you don't want the wrong person getting it. That's just like an irreversible.
Well, I mean, statistically, if you are a Black defendant and a white victim, you're much more likely to get the death penalty than if the victim was Black. So that's, you know, or so the death penalty, I mean, this is in class, so I can actually tell you what I think. Death penalty is racist as hell. Just like a lot of the, you know, a lot of the justice system. If you're a minority and you're a defendant, you better get a really good attorney, especially if it's a death penalty eligible case, because the jury is very likely to look at you as presumed guilty. So that's the truth about the death penalty.
Does that go, but like, even if the jury is a Black jury, has there been any statistics on that?
Yeah, but juries very rarely are all Black juries, and juries tend to look at Black defendants negatively regardless of their composition.
Right. But I'm saying, have there been any statistics in the cases?
I don't know. The thing is,
a lawyer strike to Black jurors who are likely to take the sides of the defendant. Like, have you ever seen like those old like 90s with like A Time to Kill? Like they always try to get the best jury to convict them.
So, wait. Did you say a movie from the 1990s is old?
Yeah.
Get out of here.
It's retro.
It's retro. Okay.
So, New York's first album already 25
years. This podcast is now over.
Professor, Professor Anna, I have a question for the professor.
Yeah.
What if the criminal, beyond a doubt, is suicidal? Is it therefore more just to give them a life penalty than a death penalty, like where they'd have to live? If what they want is to die, then...
Well, if they're suicidal, what you do is you give them... And if they're guilty?
Yes.
You put them... I mean, you give them therapy. You...
I'm not arguing with you there. I'm saying if you're working in a situation where the death penalty is what they would get.
Yeah. I don't think that just because somebody's suicidal, we should help them to die. I mean, I think there's several
questions. I don't think my question is being conveyed well. I'm saying if somebody had got the death penalty.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
But it becomes revealed that they're suicidal.
Yeah.
So essentially they're getting what they wanted. Would it then be retribution to force them to live? And have there been cases like that?
I'm not aware of cases like that. I mean, people do get suicidal on death row just because they're on death row. I mean, depression and suicidality are pretty high on death row, but also mental illness is really high on death row. And people who are mentally ill sometimes tend towards depression and suicidality.
Mm.
But the real question is, should it be up to the state to kill anybody, whether or not the person wants to die or not? What do I think?
Yeah.
I think the death penalty is one of the worst things that we do.
Yeah.
What's one of the other worst things we do?
War, torture, genocide.
What else?
Racism, xenophobia. You want me to continue? A lot of the isms. But given that the death penalty is done in the name of the people. So if you live in a state that has a death penalty, it's done in your name. You know, I think people should have a really hard think about whether or not that's something they want done in their name. Because this
I tend to agree with you. I don't think we should be giving the death penalty. But the reason I'm getting to another question, which is, why do you think the death penalty is one of the worst things we do?
It's because, like, a lot of times these people are, like, innocent on it, and they're just, like, the first person that a cop can make for the suspect. And it's just like an easy way for the state to feel like they gave retribution to a victim's family without, like, really going in, like, investigating. I've been watching a lot of documentaries because she's been studying it with her. Man, like, there's, like, some woman who's on death row right now because her daughter fell down the stairs. Is that correct?
What if it's beyond a doubt, or, you know, I guess it's never beyond a doubt, but what if it's very clear the person is guilty?
Yeah, 100% guilty. No, like, no serious doubt, right?
So then why do you think it's one of the worst things in that situation, Professor Anna?
Because I think it still dehumanizes. I think it devalues human life. I think if we can say that the state has the power to kill somebody who's already under their command, who's already subjugated under state power in prison for the rest of their life, if the state takes one more step to take that person's life, that is a step away from civilization and not towards it. It's a dehumanization.
I agree with you, but I get a lot of heat when I go on Facebook because, you know, I tend to be pretty liberal about stuff, but I don't like, you know, these new late-term abortion laws. And I've been vocal about it, and I've gotten a lot of pushback. And I guess it's because it falls in line with the same thinking of what you're saying for me. Unless the mother's life is at risk, but that, you know, that's not stipulated in these laws. So I feel like, how come we can value human life so much when it comes to this, but then we don't value it that much when it comes to that?
So this idea that people who oppose abortion are into saving life, right? That, you know, you can't. Well, what's really interesting to me is a lot of the same people who oppose abortion oppose things like healthcare. So they only seem to care for the fetus when it's still in utero.
Yeah, but I understand. I feel like I know where you're going with that. But mm-hmm. I don't care about those people. I care more about concepts, the big ideas.
The big ideas.
I don't like dragging the argument to that place because then we can get into the minutiae of all the things we don't like about certain people and certain ideologies.
No, it's not about individual people. It is actually ideas. I mean, I think, look, if you're going to say you're pro-life, be fucking pro-life all the way from birth to death.
So are you?
Whereas pro-life usually stops after birth.
Are you pro-life all the way from birth to death?
I'm not going to get into my
attitude. You're hard-hitting questions here, man. Damn.
I mean, but my point is this. If you're going to call yourself pro-life, be consistent. Own it.
I agree with you. But that's why I guess I feel that I don't even know that I would classify myself as pro-life because I think there are many appropriate situations where abortion is what I think, you know, I would support it. But I think when we start getting into this late-term abortion and it's very loosey-goosey the way the laws were written, and I suppose it's done so to make it, I think it comes from good intention. I think it's done so that people who need to get an abortion don't have to, like, deal with a lot of bureaucracy when they're in that situation already, which is, and I think I give people the benefit of the doubt, and I think most of the time when people are getting an abortion, it's because it's, you know, the health of the mother or you know, something very severe is going on. But
I think my mom actually, it's funny, like my mom's on the complete opposite side. Like she's like actually like worked for like pro-life type like organizations and stuff like that. My view on it is I think it should be legal right now, because right now I think if you were to make abortion like illegal, it will hurt a lot of people. But I think it's definitely something that could be just phased out of our country by just giving education and more birth, like on birth control and safety.
Wait, by phase out, you mean like make abortion illegal in the entire country?
No, I don't mean make it illegal. I mean make it obsolete.
Well, you can't make it obsolete entirely because not every sexual encounter is wanted or expected. Right?
No. Yeah. I guess that's true, but like when society evolves, like I feel like that, like you don't have as many like unwanted sexual encounters.
Yeah, but we're so far. And by the way, late term abortion, I understand there's a lot of hubbub about late term abortions are less than 1% of all abortions.
So I hear, but I think, you know, if it's even one life that's, you know, gone in the wrong way, then it's too many, you know?
I mean, you know, people who tell me that, I say, okay, that's fine. That's your pro-life position. Tell me why it's also not a pro-life position to demand that a cancer patient doesn't have to choose between food and chemotherapy, or why
I'm for people having health care. I'm not, like I said, I tend to be pretty liberal. I'm not in that camp, you know, like I'm pro health care. I'm pro taking care of people. I just don't see why it doesn't, in the same way that you're calling out the hypocrisy of people who say, yeah, you know, like I'm so pro-life until the person's born and then they're on their own. I see hypocrisy where I'm like, you know, okay, you want to take care of the person when they're alive. Why are we so callous in situations with abortion? I just like consistency.
I understand where you're coming from. Like, especially for someone like me, like I was born with like to a single mother, a single white mother from a black guy. I'm the person people say should get aborted, like when they talk about, you know what I'm saying? So in a way, I kind of feel like if I go completely pro-choice, I'm a fucking hypocrite. Do you ever, that's like a thing I've always dealt with in my life with like this issue.
That's interesting. Yeah,
pro-choice doesn't mean, you know, mandatory abortions for all, right?
Yeah, I know that. Yeah.
Right, but I hear what you're saying. You're saying that your mother
in a way, I think that the point you were trying to make to Anna before, like I'm maybe conflating people because of their ideologies, maybe in this point too.
And it's not like people didn't have abortions when they were illegal. They were just done with a coat hanger.
Yeah, just because I'm not
saying that they should be illegal, by the way. I think though as a country we get more abortions in America than most like other developed countries. That's a fact. And it's mostly in our poor communities and our minority communities. Like 80% of abortions or something like that in America are black and Latino. So it's like definitely something, if those are the numbers, then it's definitely something that with help could be, without making it illegal and hurting people who actually need them, which is a very few actual amount, and like giving people who are getting them, so less people will need them if there's education, I feel like.
This really speaks, I think, to the problem with our highly polarized political environment, where there seems to be no gray areas for discussion these days. I think there's so much need for these conversations to happen where people aren't just so clung to their political, you know, teams.
But, you know, just sort of stepping back from this, I think a really important distinction to make is what's a political claim and what's a moral claim. And I think what gets conflated are political commitments and moral commitments. So somebody may be pro-choice, not because they want the Democrats to win or they want the left to win, but because they're committed to the fact that a woman has a right to her bodily autonomy. I mean, that's not a political commitment. That's a moral commitment. It can also be political, but it's fundamentally moral. And I think right. we sort of view people through political lenses and we classify them that way. And we ascribe motivations and beliefs to them that they may not have.
More now than ever.
So.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you this crazy stat, actually. I read this book. I'm going to just cite this so I'm not just talking out of my butt here. This book called Influencer by Kerry Patterson and Joseph Grenny. It's basically about like certain societal problems that by mass, like a mass project management like project, like mm-hmm. they completely like fixed. So one of these things that they mentioned in this book was the AIDS epidemic in Thailand. So basically like in the 90s, Thailand, like over half of everyone in Thailand like had AIDS. It was like a crazy high rate. It was like worse than AIDS was for us in the 80s. And literally only by giving a mass like nationwide mandatory laws, new sex education and like law, new laws about wearing protection, like the AIDS rate in less than 10 years dropped to 1%. So I feel like if like a program like that could go, you could do that in a third world country and get everyone on board like that. I feel like you could help educate everyone in America if you really wanted to on exactly what to do to like avoid unwanted pregnancies. And I bet you our rates of unwanted pregnancies will be so low, abortions wouldn't be an issue, you know?
Man, I hate to rain on your parade, but we can't even get people to wear masks during a pandemic.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's a good point.
I mean,
but as long as it's, if it's not a politicized thing, if we didn't politicize that type of, if it wasn't politicized, I bet you everyone would wear masks.
But how? I mean, the reason it got politicized is because some politicians made it a statement that you know not to wear a mask. A mask is somehow virtuous and manly, and somehow brave, and it's. You know, if you're going to deny the existence of COVID-19, that it doesn't exist, I mean, it's ludicrous, right? It's crap.
Well, I think a lot of the blame also goes on the science community, and nobody likes to say it, but they've been very inconsistent with their mask mandates. Like, they started out telling us not to wear masks.
Do you know why?
Oh, okay, go ahead, why?
Dr. Fauci and all those people in the beginning, the reason, and he actually later went on the TV and explained why, and he said that the reason he did that is because there weren't enough masks, there wasn't enough PPE for doctors and nurses.
Okay, they, well, that's still dishonest. He should have been honest then.
Yeah, I agree, absolutely. They yeah. should have been honest.
People are scoundrels, so maybe he shouldn't have been honest in that situation.
Because it creates doubt in people's minds. They go, okay, now I have to take the word of a dishonest person. He's just proven himself to be dishonest.
I think there's two things here. Yes, they should have been honest. They should have said, hey, we have a shortage and mm-hmm. we have to sort of conserve for the healthcare professionals. But people also tend to think that science is never supposed to make mistakes or never supposed to trip over its own shoelaces. Basically, this idea that science somehow is supposed to be infallible, while the whole scientific method and the whole process is basically trial and error. I mean, science, it's science that admits of its own mistakes, which is why you have things like peer review. And this is something kind of my own little, something that I'm working on. I've been writing and researching a lot of working on people who have beliefs like anti-vaxxers, you know, people who don't, who believe that vaccines will kill you, people mm-hmm. who are kind of anti-science, people who are into like homeopathic, sort of, you know, wholeness, wellness communities, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of that stuff, actually, you can find it on the right and the left. It's not situated. Right. And what you find is these people are very certain about their very often magical thinking beliefs. Just today, I had a conversation with somebody who thought that you don't have to wear a mask and you don't have to socially distance. You don't even have to wash your hands if you smear yourself in a particular essential oil, like magical oil, right? I don't remember which oil, but it was, let me assure you, it was magical and sparkly. But, you know, and those people don't admit of mistakes. They look, science was wrong. Therefore, science is always wrong. Science is wrong a lot. That's why sometimes it gets things right. That's why you have peer review. You don't have too many homeopathy peer review journals for a reason.
I'll take the conversation even to another place, as what you're saying is making me think. And I've been thinking this a lot lately, and I think the reason why this nation is so divided is a lack of respect for other people's understandings and perceptions of the world. I think people on the right are disrespectful to people on the left when they bring up science, and they dismiss them, and they
want to push back on it, kind of.
Yeah, they basically say, oh, you know, you're using science as a method of control, and I don't believe in your science, and blah, blah, blah. And people on the left do the exact same thing to people on the right when it comes to religion. It's a total lack of respect for each other. Instead of listening to each other and saying, I can learn from something that from you, I don't have to agree with you, but I can respect where you're coming from, and I can walk away with a piece of what you have to offer about the world. There's a total rejection from both sides towards the other. And it's almost like a bad marriage. Wherein, you know, neither person wants to hear the other one and understand them. So, you know, from a therapy point of view, you know, and I've done a bit of therapy for
as a client or as a provider?
As a provider, I've worked in, and you have to listen to the other person. You have to, even if you don't agree with them, you have to respect them and show them that they're important and that they're heard. Make them feel heard. And the more this escalates in this country, the more each side, I sit back and I watch each side showing how much they're willing to make the other side feel unheard. And the more that happens, the more we see a divide and the more things fall apart. And it's really sad to watch.
Have you seen the it's a documentary that came out recently called The Social Dilemma?
I watched half of it and I quit on it. I thought it was a little corny.
I mean, parts of it are corny, but it's kind of about this. It's about how social media creates these bubbles, informational bubbles, sort of epistemic bubbles, right? Where we don't trust anybody outside of those bubbles, and social media amplifies that. And so you have people yelling at each other, but they're not even hearing the yelling. They're just watching each other's lips move, right? So, yeah, right. I mean, I think social media has not been the gift of social connection that maybe was the original intent.
Right, and I think the film, from what I saw of it, addressed the fact that a lot of this has to do with the social media companies manipulating the algorithms. So, yeah, I think a lot of the blame falls on the companies, and that's sort of what the film was saying. But I kind of knew that already. That's what, another reason I quit halfway through the film. Sometimes I watch something and I go, okay, I get it. You know, I'm not wasting any more time. I don't want to disrespect. If you like it and if you want to recommend it, I'm not trying to stand in the way of that.
Hey, you know the guy who invented the coder who wrote the retweet function in Twitter?
Mm-hmm.
He regrets having done that because he thinks that basically it's like putting a gun in the hand of a four-year-old. And when I was reading that, when I was watching that, it reminded me of Oppenheimer. You guys know who Oppenheimer was?
Wait, why is it like putting a gun in the hand of a four-year-old?
The retweet button? Oh, because Twitter is based on retweets and popularity, right? How many retweets somebody gets. And the kinds of things that get retweets tend to be the most hyperbolic. They tend to be the most emotionally sort of finger-pointy, right? Like, yeah. A calm tweet won't get retweeted. Something, a tweet whose hair is on fire will get retweeted.
Yeah, I see.
So the guy basically said it's like putting a gun in the hand of a four-year-old because we don't really know what we're doing because we have these brains that are really basically Stone Age brains. I mean, our brains haven't evolved that much. And our technology is way ahead of our brains, and we're having a hard time coping. And so it made me think of Oppenheimer, because Oppenheimer was one of the leading scientists in the Manhattan Project, you know, the one that developed the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And then Oppenheimer became one of the biggest anti-nuclear crusaders, because he realized that he created a genie that can't be put back in the bottle.
These people live with all this regret. You know, I've written jokes and I'm not proud of you. You move on. You write better
stuff. I think your jokes have less, I mean, as important as they are, they may have less of a global impact than Twitter and the nuclear bomb.
It's true. All right, so I'll move on to something else that I wanted to touch on the death penalty.
No, we totally covered the Vandenhoek bit, for real.
Yeah, so I wanted to just touch on something else I saw on deathpenaltyinfo.org and Business Insider. So women are rarely sentenced to death in the United States, and executions of women are even rarer. Researchers have suggested that women who are sentenced to death are often perceived as breaking gender norms. While women commit about 10% of murders, they were responsible for 35% of murders of intimate partners between 1980 and 2008. Most juries consider these crimes of passion arising from disputes, one-time offenses, Dieter said. Because of the high rate of domestic violence against women, though, juries don't give men the same benefit of the doubt. So I wanted to ask you guys, what are your thoughts on this? Is it fair that courts treat women and men differently in this case? Obviously not, I don't think so. Should crimes of passion be seen differently? What do you think?
Do you want to go for it?
Go ahead.
Crimes of passion, I mean, should they be seen differently in what sense? Like, should they be death penalty eligible?
Yeah, I guess, I'm not sure how they're categorized in the court.
The kinds of, in the states that have the death penalty, I mean, this is going to be reviewed for you, Nancy, but... you know, what matters is the mens rea. What matters is the state of mind of the offender, right? So first degree murder is different from second and third and manslaughter because of intent, right? So first degree murder has the most focus, you know, the intent is to take life. Crimes of passion very often don't have that kind of intent, because literally the person who's committing them doesn't have the time to form the intent. They're very often like, you know, when you go to a doctor and they hit your knee with the mallet and your knee bounces, it's kind of like that. You go in, you know, there's your partner in bed with somebody else. You have a gun, you use the gun. You weren't thinking about, you know, how do I kill this person? You just kind of did it. You reacted. So it very rarely would have the kind of first degree murder that's necessary for capital punishment. So that's how they're different. There are exceptions, of course.
Yeah,
I see. So, but there are way less women than men that you're being.
Yeah.
Well, what makes someone get capital punishment over life in prison?
Well, it depends.
Just
how good their lawyer is, partially. Well, I mean, look, some states just don't have capital punishment, right? So like in New York, you can't get the death sentence even if you do the exact same crime as you would in Texas. And in Texas, you would get the death penalty. So in some states, you just don't have the death penalty. But in states that you do, there are 28 states right now that have the death penalty. Then, you know, it has to be a very special kind of crime. It has to be kind of the worst crime, usually. Or sometimes it can just be first degree murder and you have a crappy lawyer.
How many degrees of murder are there?
Can be three.
How many burns are there?
Murder is a state. It's a state category. So different states have different categories.
So like how many degrees of burns are there? Are there like fifth degree burns?
There are third degree burns too.
Can you commit first degree murder by causing someone a third degree burn?
Is third degree worse than first on burns?
If you killed them,
Yeah,
and you can't just burn them, right? If you set somebody on fire, then yes. Yeah. If you set somebody on fire intentionally with the intent to kill them,
with a third degree burn, it would be a first degree murder.
Only if they're dead.
Those would be first degree burns if you set them on fire, though.
So first is the worst.
No. Third is the worst. First is the easiest. Right. First degree, well, second degree, third degree is the more serious kind of burn.
Oh, never mind.
So,
but I'm not clear what you're asking.
In that case, it's a first degree.
he's just doing puns and shit.
Oh my god.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
All right.
Hey, Daniel, I have a question for you. You said you were on the Colbert Show. What were you doing there?
I interned there.
Was it cool? Is Stephen Colbert awesome?
Depends in what respect you're asking the question. From my point of view, he was an awesome performer and an awesome host.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think he was a particularly warm person to the interns, certainly not to me. I thought, and that's not to say that he was in any way mean. He wasn't, but he was just very cold and distant, and it wasn't... I didn't think it, you know, I put myself in the position, if I was him, could I have been a little better? I think I would have been a bit better.
Damn, this podcast is going to Ellen Stephen Colbert.
I don't have anything particularly negative to say about him, but I thought, I didn't like the culture, and also the culture trickles down from the top, and I thought the culture was of the Colbert Report from the inside. It was not to my liking.
What was it like? I'm just very curious because I've watched him for a long time, and I'm just wondering what.
He's a brilliant performer. Yeah. I'd rather talk in positive terms than in negative terms because okay. I don't like to speak badly of people, and especially in a situation where somebody gave me an opportunity, like an internship at their show, even though it wasn't specifically him who gave it to me. I don't really want to speak badly of him, and people love the salacious stuff, but I rather focus on what was great about it, honestly. And what was great about it was that I got to watch him rehearse. Mm-hmm. And he was just such a polished performer. I watched him read lines for the very first time that he'd seen them on the teleprompter, and he did it with such finesse. It was like better than most people's like 80th take. It was his first take. And I was really blown away by that. And the other thing I got out of it was I was very impressed with his confidence. Now, whether or not it was a show of confidence, I don't think that matters. I mean, he projected confidence. And I remember one night walking to the Broadway Comedy Club from my internship, which was pretty close to there, to do a spot. And I thought to myself, I'm going to feign confidence like Steven has. I'm going to get up on the stage and project that confidence in my set tonight as if I'm Steven. And I remember, I was never able to recreate it, but that night I had one of the greatest sets of my life. And I just picked up a little bit of that magic from watching him with his confidence. Again, you know, there were some also really awesome people I got to meet at the internship that worked there. But on the whole, I felt that it was a cutthroat television environment and it wasn't fun and it wasn't anything I'd hoped it was going to be. And Stephen, who I'd hoped I'd at least get to share a few words with over the months that I worked for free there, had absolutely no interest in conversing with the interns.
Can you blame him?
Well, I used to bring him his lunches and I used to walk to this Cuban sandwich shop where I would get him his lunch.
Oh, really? You personally got him Cuban sandwiches?
Yes. It wasn't just Cuban. I think it was Cuban owned, but it was a sandwich shop.
And got him sandwiches. He didn't even try to speak to him when you gave it to him?
Well, it wasn't Cuban sandwiches. He would get the same sandwich. It was a baguette with brie cheese and green apples and ham on it.
That's some weird shit right there.
It's actually pretty good. So that's
what he would get. I would walk over to the store. I'd pick up his sandwich. I'd bring it to him in his office. And, you know, when I talk about that he was cold, You know, this is what I'm referring to. And again, it's nothing so bad, but he would sit at his desk and he would have his eye on what he was doing. And I would say, I have your lunch. And he'd just go, you know, just point, like put it there
at the desk.
And it wasn't like, thank you so much or anything. And look, what do I need? People to make a fuss out of me? And that's not the culture of television, but that's why I chose not to go into television. I'm a sensitive soul. And I wasn't cut out for that type of thing.
And yet you're in comedy clubs. It seems like a soft place to land.
I don't like them either, to be honest with you.
What do you want to do when you grow up?
Well, I'm doing it. This is a good lead-in to promote it. This is my new one. I've been making autobiographical comic books.
Oh, cool.
This one is available for Thanksgiving. They're called Fair Enough. Here, I'll show everybody.
And they're available
at fairenoughcomic.com. Sorry?
Is that supposed to be you?
That's me.
Who's
as
that
a
on the cover?
That's me as a Macy's balloon.
Okay.
And it's like a lot of me's holding up me. And then it's stories of growing up in New York and going to the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade with my family and the stories of Thanksgivings over the years and the people who I've lost and the people who have come into my life and how my life is sort of like chronicled through Thanksgivings. And the art is by a really talented artist, local artist named Josh Spooner. And then the story that it all leads up to is the time that my wife and I snuck into the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade and we marched 20 blocks in the parade. and there we are we were on every news station because we were right in front of Santa Claus. And it was just, you know, this random couple waving to everybody in front of Santa Claus. And the newscaster's like, and here comes Santa Claus being led by some couple, I guess. So that's the new issue of Fair Enough.
That's awesome. Perfect for Thanksgiving.
Yeah. These just arrived today, so I'm mailing them out to people. If you order them at fairenoughcomic.com, please support the arts. Very long plug. I apologize for that. But
so where could people find?
Seemed like you guys were all interested, so I kept going. But
I personally have nothing to plug right now. I have two books out, but I don't think they need plugging. So.
Oh yeah.
Well, what's one? Give us one of the titles, and we'll look it up.
I mean, one is called The Moral Psychology of Sadness, and another one is called The Moral Psychology of Regret. They're both collections. Of essays with Roman and Littlefield International, and you can get them on Amazon, and they're expensive. Cool.
Awesome. And where can we follow you guys?
Well, Nyanzi can follow me on Thursday to class. I don't know. I mean, I don't, like I said, I'm working on a website. I have a website at Brooklyn College, but it's just kind of boring and corporate. That's about it. I mean, I have a Twitter account, but it's a little dead right now.
I'm not much more exciting. Sorry to tell you guys, my Twitter is also dead, and my Facebook is locked. I mean, Josh, you and I are Facebook friends, but once you're in, you're in.
Are you in Facebook jail?
What?
You're in Facebook jail right now, Danny?
No. I mean, it's not open to the public.
Give people your Instagram and Twitter if you want people to follow you.
I mean, I don't know. I don't really update them. You could just look my name up, Daniel Lobel, but I don't like Instagram because it's too much vanity, and I don't like Twitter because it's too much censorship. They don't let you type as much as you want. So I don't care for those platforms, but I do like podcasts.
You do like type very long statuses on Facebook.
Right, I like the freedom to express myself in as many words as I like.
Yeah, but, I have a Facebook account too, but it's not locked, and I guess you can find me on Facebook. I may or may not friend you. I don't know.
And then, you can follow both of us on both Instagram and Twitter. Our podcast has an Instagram page called BWT Podcast, and you can see all of it. We have new artwork for every episode. Like album art, and we release like a 2-minute clip of our favorite moments of each episode on our podcast page. Also, you can follow me at both Instagram and Twitter at Gosh Carter. That's GOSHCARTER.
And you can follow me at Miss Nayanci, MSNAYANCI on Instagram and Twitter.
And thank you guys for joining us for the But Why Though podcast.